This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, all of my listeners know that I love to talk to authors who have just come out with their first book, a debut book, and it is a winner. So I am so happy to welcome to the program William Ian Grubman, and the name of the book is The Storm Over Paris. And I tell you, it is a fascinating book. Hi, William.
Good morning.
Well, good morning to you. You're awake up there in California?
It's an early morning. It's still gray outside, but I'm sure it'll be a lovely day.
Okay. Well, I am thrilled that you are on the program today because
Thank you.
Storm Over Paris is wonderful, and you must be so proud that it won the 2019 Indie Reader Discovery Award in Mystery Thriller Suspense, and it was a finalist in the 2019 National Indie Excellence Award.
The response to the book is overwhelming for me. I truly didn't expect it.
Well, it deserves all of the compliments that you're getting and that you're going to be getting because it is a fascinating, as I said, it's a fascinating book. I was, when I started reading it, I knew what it was going to be about, but once I got into it, I couldn't stop reading it. It's very exciting. There are so many, you know, it's nice that it won in this thriller suspense category because it is suspenseful. It's set in 1942 in Paris, and you have to tell us all about your research and into it. But as it starts, you know, with a very, very nice prologue that leads us into the story. And I was always sort of on tenterhooks. What's going to happen to this family? So tell us about this fascinating family that you created here, a family of art, you know, art collectors and sellers. And tell us about the entire family.
Well, when I started to write the book, which I was writing under another title, the story was going to take place in New York, present day, and it started with the character in my prologue. And when I finished the prologue, I thought to myself, I don't think this takes place. I think I need to go back in time. And that's where the hook came into, let's use World War II as a vehicle to tell my story. I wanted to make sure that the reader turned every page because they had to turn the page, not because, well, the story is continuing, but I wanted every page to end with another hook. And that's what I strive for in the story, to make sure that constantly the reader was on edge. And I also wanted to keep my characters on edge.
Well, you obtained your objective because, as I said, it starts off with the prologue in, you know, present day, and then we go back in time, back to April 1942 in Paris. And for anyone who's been to Paris, you do always remember that it was once occupied. It's hard, you know, as you're walking the streets in Paris, it's hard to imagine that this beautiful city was occupied and that people were living under absolute terror. And then every once in a while you'll see a bullet hole or you'll see something that will remind you that it's true. So when you went back, you decided to go back to 1942, what was your background in that? Had you had that same feeling when you were in Paris?
Well, I've been to Paris many times, and I spent a lot of time in Paris researching the story. But what I was most concerned about in talking about the war was the color of the war. And when I think about World War II, and when I speak to groups, I always ask the question, what color was World War II? Close your eyes and tell me the color. And everybody opens their eyes and say, okay, how many people thought World War II was black and white when they had their eyes closed, and the whole room raises their hands. when in fact, obviously, that everything was in color, and I wanted to paint a colorful story, not a happy story, but I wanted my reader to see the colors of the story, to see that Paris was beautiful during the war, that no matter what was happening there, the city was still beautiful, and the artwork was beautiful, and the architecture was beautiful. And that's what I wanted to get across. So I decided to, another question I usually ask people is, what was the temperature during World War II? Inevitably, everybody answers, it was cold. So I set my story purposely in spring and summer and ended in fall so that people would see the beautiful colors of summer in the story. But I needed the tension and I needed the terror, and that I had to bring out using the characters.
And you do, and the interesting thing about the way you wrote it, it's not, the terror is, it's just like a blanket. It's there, but it's not all this, it's not all horror. So it's almost worse. You know, sometimes if a book just has endless beatings or endless killings and endless, you don't quite, you know, have that same feel that I got in your book, because we know it's there. We know things, such terrible things can happen. As you said, on a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day. The sky is blue. The people are you know, beautiful to look at. And there are people who are still, you know, eating, you know, baguettes. But there's always this layer that you never know when it's going to strike.
I had to cloak the story in fear. And that was my goal, was to create fear in every scene. Yet the scene could be quite beautiful. The party scene at the Ritz Hotel was a lovely scene, but it was a scene that was cloaked in fear because Maury didn't know what was happening next.
Exactly. I mean, you got it so perfectly, because as I said, you know, I read a lot of books and I get a lot of World War II books, and sometimes it's one torture scene after another, one murder after another, and it sort of wears you down. But this, it doesn't, because you have this flow and the interesting family, a fascinating family that you've developed here. So you have to tell us about the entire family, how you came out with it, because I thought you did a beautiful job in developing them. But you did create that tension of not knowing. I mean, we're really, we don't know what's going to happen. And it's so wonderful. I love the ending. So, but we won't talk about that, because we want people to read the book. But so tell us about the family.
Well, Maury's, they're a very down-to-earth family. For a very wealthy family, they're extremely well-adjusted. And they do very normal family things, same as a family today. Maury gets up and goes to work every day. Unfortunately, during World War II, Maury, as an art dealer in Paris, didn't have a lot of work, because that was not a time people were spending money. His wife cooks the meals. She oversees the house. She's smart. Maury's wife, Ruth, is an incredibly smart woman. She's very pretty, but she knows how to manipulate the system to make it work for her family. And she's a typical mother bird. She watches over everybody to make sure everything's okay, until we see Ruth starting to fall apart toward the end of the book. And it's the grip of war that has her. I chose not to show a great deal of brutality in the story, because I felt I could create the fear without the blood and the guts. And I think my most difficult scene were the scenes that were in the velodrome with Maury's son, Jacob.
We won't tell too much about that. But,
yeah.
But that's exactly what you did. You create this very family that we can relate to. The Rothsteins are, I love the relationship between Maury and his wife. They have a very typical loving relationship, and as you said, she does the cooking and she's the mother hen, and there they are in Paris in 1942. They come from a family that, you know, they've been in this art business for quite a while. They're well-known people. They have a beautiful home, And this is part of the terror of that you have underlined in the story, that these are just normal people living lovely lives. They thought everything was fine, and it wasn't, because all of this other stuff could happen and did happen. And 1942, those who didn't, who hadn't had the foresight to leave, they were stuck.
They were stuck. What I tried to do was create a human touch to the story. I tried to humanize everybody, including Hermann Göring. We know what a horrible person he was, and we know all the terror that World War II wrecked over Europe. But I wanted to show a different side of the person. And although I let the reader know how bad he was, I also showed that side of Göring that was a normal person. This was a guy that had likes of certain things. He liked art. He liked music. And I wanted to create a difficult situation for Maury, because Maury struggled constantly with the relationship he had with Hermann Göring. At some points in time, I wanted Maury to feel that he and Göring were friends, and while knowing he hated the man at the same time. And that's the dance I tried to create between those two men.
And it is true that, you know, when you look back on it and on that period of time, there were people there. I mean, some Germans were very, you know, cultured, and in this case, Göring really loved art. That the fact that he wanted to steal it all, you know, like, okay, but you know, I you did create this complex relationship between them that I, you know, it reads very well.
Thank you very much. I felt that was important for the story, and I felt the closer those two men got, the more tension it created within Maury's family. And then, of course, it created a great deal of tension in Göring's extended family, which would have been the underlings underneath him that worked with him and with Maury.
And, of course, in the family, we have the two sons. And, again, a relationship here that is complex, because Emil and... oh my goodness, my mind went.
His brother Jacob.
Jacob, Emil, and Jacob. They're two different types of people, and yet when all of this happens, they have to come together and really work together to keep the family, you know, going on.
It was teamwork within a family that was wrecked with total havoc.
Now, when you came out with the idea for the family, and of course set the stage for them to get involved in all of this work working with the Nazis in essence. I mean, Maury was working with the Nazis. It was so difficult. Did you actually ever meet any people, French Jewish people who had stayed behind and lived through that?
I didn't. I had to use only my research.
Because I've met some Jewish people who actually stayed in Vienna and survived it.
I interviewed people, yes, that lived out of Paris, but I didn't interview anybody that actually lived in Paris at that time.
Because it I can see, you know, when you're in Paris, you can see that you never want to leave it. And you can't, you, in one, you know, the part of you says, why didn't you just get out? Why didn't you get out? And then, you know, it was so beautiful. And it was, and you, they had such a lovely life. And I mean, particularly for people who are involved in the art business, they had the art. I mean, that, they were surrounded with it and with famous artists. So, wow, it's you
they
can't fault them.
Maury had it all. He had the beautiful art. He had his gorgeous city. He had money. And you know, he had everything, and yet he had nothing. He was totally out of control.
Now, when you were, of course, you tell us a little bit about your background, why you know so much, because you write, of course, so beautifully about the artworks. And this is a fascinating story I think most people know, they've seen it in the movies, that the Germans came in and they were just taking everything that was left behind, everything that the French had not hidden. So tell us about that. What did you discover about that?
First of all, most of the artwork that I reference in the story is true. Some of the pieces had to be sort of tweaked or created to make the story work and to make the story plausible. So I want your readers to know that. And a great deal of the characters in the story that my characters interact with were, in fact, historical figures. They actually existed. And I wanted that to be an important part of the story, too, because I wanted the people to realize these were people that were flowing in and out of my story. Rose Valland, Coco Chanel, these were people that interacted with the Nazis. So I wanted that to be true. As far as the art goes, the research on the art was endless. I could have gone on and on and on with it because, I wanted to have all this beauty within all this horror at the same time. And I got off track and I forgot what your question was, and I apologize.
Well, no, but about how you know so much about art, because one of the things I and this happened with me, I'm reading the book, and it's hard to stop, but every once in a while I just had to remind myself of an artist's work, and I would click on the internet and look up the artist, and then I would have all these images in my head, and I kept thinking, I wish there were photos in this book, because I'm having to stop every once in a while just to get the feel of the art and have it in my head again. So, but you describe things beautifully.
I have studied art my entire life. It's just something I enjoy. And I started collecting when I was 17 years old. And then as an adult, I became a docent at one of our museums in Los Angeles. And that allowed me entree into the doctorate program of art history at UCLA, because I was a docent, I could audit the art history classes for free. So I started taking art history classes, and it just went from there. So it's just something I have a passion for and I love.
Well, as I said, your description of the art and of the artists and of the work are just spot on. It makes you, whenever a book makes you want to know more about a subject, when you're reading this and you say, wow, he's talking about Caravaggio, I need to know more, I need to look it up, or you're talking about Picasso, it's wonderful to just have a look at his work and be reminded of what it looks like. So I thought all of that part, the art, is written beautifully.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I wanted the reader to see the beauty of it. To leave the reader with the question, how could there be so much beauty during war? And there was.
And as you mentioned, Coco Chanel, I think many people will be surprised when they read this book. They don't know that there were famous people who stayed behind, who didn't leave Paris.
Well, it was interesting. Coco Chanel only had one store in her lifetime, or one major store in Paris, and it was outside the back door of the Ritz Hotel. And she had an apartment there, yet during the war she actually chose to live in the Ritz Hotel, and she was the only person living in the Ritz Hotel other than the German high command who had taken it over during that time.
It's amazing when you go to Paris, and actually they don't let you walk into the Ritz Hotel. Very few people get to actually walk into the Ritz Hotel anymore. But in the old days, you used to be able to walk in, and to imagine how they took over the hotel as their headquarters.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, the hotel hasn't really changed much since World War II. It's been refurbished and redone on and on and on, and it's the most magnificent hotel in Paris. But the general layout of the hotel has remained pretty much unchanged since that time. So as I described the walkways or the areas that Maury was traveling through within the hotel, those exist today.
Yeah, I know, because when we were in Paris, we were in the hotel, and so when you're describing it, I mean, I could visualize it because I had been there. Now, the reason that we did not stay at the Ritz Hotel, the reason we got into the Ritz Hotel, as you know, now they have a lot of security people. You know, there are too many famous people in the hotel that they don't let just anyone walk in. The reason we got in, my husband was wearing a cowboy hat, and somehow that impressed them, and they let us come in. So it was nice, and I got to talk to some people in the hotel, so it was lots of fun.
It's a beautiful place, and I thought it would be a great area to create a scene or several scenes with Goring.
Now, you know, I was wondering, you know, this is your first novel? I mean,
this is my first.
Like,
this is actually the first of three in this series. There will be three stories that deal with Maury and his family.
Well,
I'm working on book two now.
It's amazing. I always love when I talk to an author when they come out with a debut novel, you know, like how much writing background you had, because you know sometimes novelists will have like they've done 10 novels and they never published any. I don't know if that's what happened with you, because this is such a very, I mean, it's so well done, it's so well written that I was blown away with it. I thought, this is really fantastic.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I have no writing experience.
Wow.
I have a friend who's a professor of writing at UC Irvine. And when I started to write the book, I wrote the prologue and then didn't know what I was doing or where I was going. And I called her up and I said, you know, I'd really love to take your class. And I'm on the west side of Los Angeles, which is a 2.5-hour drive from Irvine. So I said, would you consider, and I don't want to come every day to the school, it's too difficult, would you teach me your class privately? And she did, and I worked with her for a couple of years, and during that time, the only writing I worked on was the book. So every assignment she gave me was always about my book. And that's how I was actually able to understand how to write a book. She walked me through every single process of it.
Well, she did a great job, but this comes from, there's something in you where the story came to your, I don't know, sometimes stories come full-blown into a person's mind, and they can see the whole thing at once, but sometimes as you develop characters, they take on a life of their own, and they start controlling your writing.
Which is what happened with this book. I had no outline, didn't know where it was going, and it just started to... It started to morph itself into its own story.
Well, as I said, I had a feeling that was what happened, because there's something about the way it flows, the way I felt like, almost like we're on a ride with you. We're on a lovely trip, and we're going back in time, and we're flowing along with the reader is flowing along with you, and I thought, whoa, this is fun. I felt like, you know, when you describe walking the streets in Paris, and of course, I think some people will actually get out the Google Map and they'll want to walk the streets. There's so much in this book that is very visual, and it's always great when a author can write very visually so that you feel like you're in that spot at that moment, and I'm just having so much fun, you know, going along with each scene as you lay them out. I think the chapter lengths are just perfect. It just goes from, you know, chapter to chapter. I just admire your writing so much.
I'm so flattered. Thank you very much. I actually wrote the book with a map sitting beside me the entire time.
Well, you know, and I always have maps of Paris around me. It's like an obsession with me. I have a box of Paris maps, from old ones to new ones. It's really, as I said, you managed to create that feeling for us, going back in time to 1942 in Paris. Now, I want to talk to you about other things. I want to talk to you about yourself. I want to talk to you about the Audible book that is being made. But I have to take a commercial break. So will you hold on, and we'll
of
be
course.
Right back. And I want to talk. You have somebody very special doing your Audible book.
I do.
Okay. So we'll be right back. I want to talk about him. Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am talking to William Grubman, the author of The Storm Over Paris, an award-winning novel that is absolutely fantastic. And everyone, I want to tell you that you will enjoy this read. It is so fascinating, and I am so happy to be talking to you today, William.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I hear that you're going to have an Audible version of this book soon, right?
I am. Hopefully it'll be released in the next 2 weeks.
Wow. And tell us. Oh, I'm so thrilled. I was so thrilled when I heard who is your narrator.
Nicholas Guy Smith is reading my book.
Oh, I love him.
He has a magnificent voice.
He is my favorite narrator. He's been on the program. He was on the program because Amor Towles, A Gentleman in Moscow. He is such a wonderful narrator and such a wonderful person. It's so funny. I sometimes will start when I'm doing a speech at a book conference or something, I will say, the only man who's I ever go to sleep with other than my husband is Nicholas Guy Smith.
He does have a terrific voice.
Because
he?
I've listened to A Gentleman in Moscow a dozen times. I keep it on. Sometimes I can be doing the laundry. I just love to hear his voice, and so I was so thrilled. It's very rare. I don't actually know any other radio program that ever invites the narrator of a book on, but I invited. The reason I invited. Nick, when after I had you know, I had interviewed Amor Toros a number of times, and then I had Nick on, and the people were just blown away with his reading, and I know that everyone will just love it so much. And so I will have him on, and maybe I will have both of you on again, so we can do a little bit of a him reading live, because sometimes people are just intrigued once they hear the words and your story. Would pick some of the sections that, you know, are particularly interesting to be read over the radio, just to get people excited about reading this great book.
Well, I think when people actually hear the words, they'll love the sound.
Oh.
He's done a beautiful job with it.
Well, he is just great. And of course, but it all comes back to the words. And I was going to tell you, not only do I love your descriptions of Paris and your descriptions of the characters, but I'm also I've been very lucky the past few weeks. I've been getting authors whose dialogue is very good. You have a very visual dialogue, the type of dialogue that, you know, you're reading it, but you're seeing it in your head too.
Well, I tried to have my characters speak as normal as possible, yet as normal as they might have spoken at that time period. And I struggled with that back and forth, the slang they might use, local expressions, etc. But it all seemed to come together.
Well, it did. And I like little things that you are sort of unexpected, like the washing machine. I'm not even going to talk about the washing machine scene, but, you know, all these little things that sort of take us back in time, and we're like amazed, well, that was going on then. And just little things throughout the book. There are little twists and turns. And if people are clever enough, they might guess one thing that's going to happen. But you just managed to build up the suspense.
I'm flattered you enjoyed it. I truly am.
Now let's talk a little bit about yourself. I don't normally give an author the entire hour, but I wanted to do that for you for several reasons. One, I think that I knew that this was, you know, something that you come to a little bit later in life than a lot of people. That, you know, and I want one of the things I always say at the beginning of my program, this is a program for writers and those who dream of writing. Now, I don't know if you were dreaming of writing all of your life, but once you did it, once you started, boy, I mean, you went full blast into it. And I think that's a wonderful thing for people to know, that it's never too late to write a best-selling book, because I think this is going to be a bestseller. And a book, now, of course, I knew when I came to the end that you had those three little words that to be continued. I was so happy that we're going to be going back to the story of the Rothsteins and learning more about them.
Well, first I can share with you that the book became a bestseller two weeks ago on Amazon. So I'm thrilled about that.
Well, it's well deserved, and it's going to, I think, keep building as people hear more and more about it. It's going to, you know, get even more exposure.
Oh, I hope so. I've always been a believer that as we age, things get better. And at the same time, because we reach a certain point in our lives, doesn't mean we have to stop. I retired about 12 years ago, and my retirement, I was very clear, was not going to take place on a golf course. And it was a time in my life that now I'm going to do all the things I've always wanted to do that I didn't have time to do because of work schedules, family schedules, etc. And this is the time for me, and the book was one of the first things that I started to work on, among other things. But I think you have to keep pushing. There's no reason to stop and get old. Just because we get old doesn't mean we're done.
Exactly.
It's
a,
for me, it's a starting point.
And I mean, you were a businessman. No, you know, you're a very successful businessman. And sometimes people will say, well, you know, that's he's made it. He's a successful businessman. But that's not the end. I mean, you can do more. You can do so many things, and you certainly have proven it.
I've tried my best. I've done everything from being a commercial pilot, a commercial jet pilot, to being part of corporate America for 45 years.
And now I understand you're an entertainer.
I am. My lifelong dream was to perform on the stage. That was truly the lifelong dream. And my parents weren't going to have any part of that. So they pushed me in other directions. But it really was. And about 6 years ago, together with my older sister and some friends of ours, we started a singing group that has sort of morphed itself into a duet now. So I sing with my sister, and we perform all over. We performed in New York, in California, and we're all over the United States, and we're taking our show on the road to England and France in the fall.
Well, I think that's marvelous, because it's funny. I was very, very shy, but I had the opportunity at one point. My boys were in a production of Fiddler on the Roof, and they needed another peasant in the background, you know, one of the villagers, and they needed somebody, and they turned to me and said, "Do you want to do it?" I was sitting there watching my boys, you know, in the program, and I tell you, once I got on stage, I loved it so much. It is so fun. It's just so much fun to be on stage. And I thought, I mean, by the end, I was ready, you know, to take over the main roles. I was ready to knock everybody off the stage, because it is so much fun. And I do encourage people, just sometimes you think you can't do it, and then, wow, you can do amazing things, right?
I think there's nothing you can't do if you decide it's something you want to do it, with an obvious reason.
Yeah.
But yes, I think there's no reason not to do everything, or at least try.
Exactly. Why not? You know, what do you have to lose? At least you've tried, and you can say, I tried. And of course, in your case, I mean, you know, becoming a jet pilot, you know, after years in business is something quite exceptional. Now, my husband was a jet pilot, but he came up through the Air Force. So it was a wonderful thing that you did.
I loved it. I loved flying. I stopped when I had children. I don't know why. I just thought, oh, this is the time I need to focus on them and not be doing things that could potentially be dangerous. But I miss it at times, and I really did love it. I loved the feel of controlling an aircraft that went so fast. It was wonderful.
And of course, now one of the things that having become, you know, successful in business, you've been able to do a lot to help people. And I wanted to mention that you are involved in camps to help children, because I want to, during the summer, I like to encourage particularly camps or organizations that help children to learn and to read. And I like to donate books to local organizations. So tell us a little bit about your involvement in helping children.
Well, 30 years ago, my sister and I decided we wanted to start a program for children with life-threatening and chronic illnesses, where they could come to summer camp and enjoy the activities that their illnesses prevented them from enjoying. So we created what we call Dream Street. And Dream Street is a series of summer camps that host children who can't go to camp, the normal camp that we think about. They need medicine multiple times a day. They need doctors on hand and nurses on hand. Some of them have medical restrictions. And we provide all of that. So we provide them the entire camping experience while covering every medical need they have. And that was important for us to do. We have camps in California, Arizona, Arkansas, Mississippi, New Jersey, and in Massachusetts. And they're wonderful programs.
Well, I think that is, it's so touching. I love when people are out there trying to help others. And in your case, you've done so much to help children who are suffering. Is such a wonderful thing to do. And I hope that, you know, one of the things I you might be already wealthy, but I hope that your book will help bring you more attention, because that's one of the ways that you can help. You can help raise awareness. The sort of the more famous you become as an author, just like David Baldacci, who does so much for children, and he's given, I think he and his wife have given like 2 million books to homeless shelters, because this is one of the areas that people don't realize that, you know, people go to pick up food at homeless shelters, and most of them have their kids along, and because of David Baldacci and his wife, they now can pick up books, you know, to go along with the food. And so what you're doing to help children who are suffering illnesses and who need that camp experience, I think is just wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. We're very proud of the program, and we feel we do really good work for these kids.
Now, you mentioned, let's get back to writing for a minute before I have to go on to something else. You mentioned, of course, this is going to be a trilogy. So you've already started your second book.
I have. That first book was Maury's story. In the second book, we're going to follow closely Emile.
Okay.
And we'll be back in Paris for the second book.
So Emile is the son who is an artist and who has a non-Jewish girlfriend.
Correct. Correct.
So
in book two, he's married.
He's married. Well, we're glad about that. All of us. And then are we going to go further back in time to the beginning of the Rothstein family?
No, we're actually going to pick up the story where I left off.
Uh-huh.
We're going to return to Paris after the war.
Okay.
I can't give the secrets I know I left you with a few questions at the end of this book, and I have to make sure the reader understands those are all cleared up.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, as I said, it's wonderful what you've done. You've really created, I think, you know, it's so much fun. Whenever I talk to an author who's really come out with their first book, and to know that I'm in a little way a part of helping to promote the author and the book, and to be able to follow up with you over the next few years when the next book comes out, I'm going to have you back with Nick, I think.
I'd be honored.
Because I just love Nick, and I would love to have some of my listeners who, you know, oftentimes people, they hear about Audible books, but they haven't tried them. And then, whoa, when they hear somebody like Nick, they say, not only do I want to hear the Audible book, but so many people, they also then buy the book, because you want both. You want to hear Nick, and you want the book in your hand too. So I think it's a wonderful thing. And as you know, Audible books are very big. And this is still June, and June is Audible Book Month. And so I want to compliment you on getting the very best person in the industry. I think he's the tops.
I think so too.
And I'm sure it's going to be exciting. But every time you have a release, I want you to make sure you send me the. That's the fun thing about this job, you know. I get to read books before anybody else, and I love it. I get so excited. I don't have to wait. So as soon as the next book is ready to come out, you have me on your list. And
I promise.
And I will. And of course, I will say this too. I don't know, you're in California already, and I am sure people are reading the book over there. And we will at some point have, right? We are going to have it on streaming video.
I hope so.
I know so. So when that happens, it's going to be an exciting time, and You'll have like a big launch party for the when it gets onto Netflix or Apple or one of those ones. If not in the big screen, it's going to be streaming. And when you have a big party, invite me, and I'll come over and I'll be able to actually meet you, because I love meeting the authors whose books I admire, and I so admire this book. It's called.
That's an invitation I look forward to extending.
Okay, and it's called The Storm Over Paris, and it's by William. Well, I won't. It's your middle name is Ian, which I like. I love that name.
Thank you.
But William Grubman, and your website is simply
William Grubman.
And everybody can see you there and find out more about you and see a picture of you as an entertainer. Okay.
There you go.
All right. Yeah. So William Grubman, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's been a joy to talk to you, William.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye now. Bye. Oh right. What a week. I've had such a great week. My goodness, I have had authors and fantastic authors. This has been really exciting. So, okay, everybody, I wanted again to remind you that I have on Tuesday, I have one of my favorite authors, and he's going to be back on here, John Gilstrap, and I met him at BoucherCon back in October, and it was just wonderful to meet him. And I'm always happy to have him on, because he writes lots of wonderful books, and it's going to be fun. Also, I wanted to play a book buzz. We have a book buzz ready. Let's play a book buzz, and then I'm going to come back and say bye-bye.
Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz mystery. The House on Xenia by Rita Moreau is the fifth in the delightful Mary Catherine Mahoney mystery series, if I may say so myself. Here's the buzz. When a body is unearthed at the House on Xenia, long-held secrets could be revealed, but no one is talking, especially the aliens. Mary Catherine Mahoney, MC, prefers numbers to her supernatural powers. But when a cold case corpse shows up under her cousin's family home, the only calculations that add up are paranormal. And deep within the floorboards of the House on Xenia, MC and her madcap Greek family uncover evidence pointing to visitors from another planet. Pursued by military agents intent on keeping the secrets buried, MC will have to play by the rules of the House on Xenia in order to expose the alien mystery. And there's only one member of the family who can get to the hidden truth. The House on Xenia can be read as a standalone in the Mary Catherine Mahoney Cozy Mystery Series. If you like psychic female sleuths, crazy family antics, and long-lost aliens, then you'll love Rita Moreau's quirky tale, if I may say so myself. This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions on the books you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joyonpaper. Rita Moreau, buzzing off for now.
Okay, well, I wanted to play that for Rita. Rita Moreau is the one who does our book buzzes all the time, and she just released her new book on Tuesday, and it's available wherever books are sold online. Go to Amazon, and she also is having, there's a party for her tonight at Indian Shores Library, but I think it's a little too late to get you to, well, you never know. Call them up, and if you're in the area, call them up, the library, and see if you can get in tonight, because it's going to be fun. You'll get to meet Rita, and there will be a lot of other authors, local authors there to celebrate with her, because she's so wonderful, and she loves to read mysteries, and so it's really exciting when she comes in and she does a whole bunch of mystery reviews of mysteries. And one of the authors that she's reviewed and whose books that she enjoys is Tasha Alexander. And if you are, there are two series that I would like to recommend to you if you want to do a really sort of a a binge. They're binge worthy for the summer. There are two authors that I'd like to recommend to you. Carol J. Perry, she writes Witch City Mysteries, and you can start from the beginning. Just start from the beginning and go right through them. She's now gotten a new contract, so she's going to have 12 books in the series. It's really exciting. And then Tasha Alexander. I love Tasha Alexander's books. It's called the Lady Emily series, and the wonderful things about these books are they're all set in England. Well, they're not all set in England. They're about an English lady, but they are set around Europe. So you actually get to tour Europe with Lady Emily from Paris to Vienna to Venice. It's just wonderful. They're wonderful books, and so it's really worth doing some binge reading. I think she has now 14 books in her series. You know, when they start writing that many books, then they start to get to that point where maybe if they're lucky, Hallmark Channel will start paying attention to them and, you know, pick up their books to make a series. And I really wish they would, because I must say that I need some new and exciting series out there to watch on television. And both of these would be absolutely fantastic. And that's Carol J. Perry and Tasha Alexander. So if you're looking for some binge reading for the summer, just, you know, take the books down to the pool or on the beach, and you will have fun, and you will not. And the nice thing about both of these authors, they're smart, they're intelligent, and so you learn a lot as you go along. You know, whether you learn about furniture, clothing, or capital cities of Europe, you will learn something, and they're lots of fun. And again, as Rita said, go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper.com, and you can see and some of the, you can hear a lot of the interviews and also see some of the photos and things from my trip to New York. And it was exciting, and I will be talking more about that throughout the summer as I talked to some of the agents who I had a chance to meet while I was in New York. And again, what else? I want to tell you all that I've had so many things to say this week, but it's been a crazy, crazy week, and I'm heading into the weekend, so it's going to be really exciting. I have a lot of writers that I'm going to be meeting over the weekend, so I'm looking forward to that. And of course, I have more books to read. I just got another 8 books yesterday. My goodness, this is getting wild. Anyway, remember what I always say: one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or maybe a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, but you have to start writing a page a day. And, you know, I will talk next week about how many words some authors write every day. They have rules, and they actually meet it every day. So we'll be talking about that next week. But right now, just start with a page a day. By next Tuesday, you'll have five pages ready, and you can call me and say, I did it. That'll be fantastic. I'd love to hear from you. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, and he's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Oh, I always get that military feeling. Pride. Okay, bye-bye now. Have a great weekend.